Oborne and Hella on Cricket, brought to you by the Chiswick Calendar.
Hello, I'm Peter Oborne. I'm in my office in Wiltshire, and looking out of the window, the weather is such perfect cricketing weather that it's torture.
Hello, I'm Richard Heller. I'm experiencing the same sensations in my home in Rubato Towers, London South East, where birds are twittering, sun is shining, and it's unbearable not to be playing cricket.
At the moment, no cricket is being played anywhere in the world. Is there any chance, Richard, that we're going to get any in the near future? I mean, in Britain, the levels of infection are coming down.
I'm very gloomy about prospects of play here for a considerable period, partly on health grounds. I think there's a lot of uncertainty about the incidence of the virus, about testing, about the extent to which it's actually spread and is being brought under control. And also for political reasons, which we'll perhaps come to, I'm worried that cricket may not have the political clout to make a claim on any relaxation of the coronavirus restrictions. Worldwide, the picture is very, very confused, and it depends on, obviously, the development of the virus in every other country and its the success of its measures. But the crisis in world cricket has a knock-on effect in English cricket because it means, of course, that overseas visitors may not be able to visit our country. We've almost certainly lost the West Indian tour that was due to come at the beginning of the season. We've got three other international visitors. We've got Pakistan, Australia, Ireland. No certainty about whether they'll be able to come. No certainty about whether overseas players will be able to join the domestic British competitions that they're contracted to do. So a lot of uncertainty in Britain and worldwide.
So the West Indies are due to come at the end of May. So that's, well, I think we can assume that's not going to happen. Pakistan, the Lord's Test isn't till the end of July. Surely there must be a chance that certain things get back to a bit like to normal and that we could have the Pakistan season?
Could do, although the problem is, outside of Test matches, whom are they going to play when they're over here?
I mean, what about the idea, which I like, is that the cricket matches can be played behind closed doors? Because cricket itself, you don't get very close to people. I mean, there you are. You know, you're at fine leg or at mid-on and the batsman is 22 yards away from the bowler. And so you can play observing the social distancing rules set by the government. And all right, you can't fill up Lords of spectators, which is tragic, but you can watch it on the telly. Why shouldn't they do that?
Well, there are a lot of problems with that. First of all, the players hate playing matches with no live audience. We've heard Misbah and Yunus in Pakistan talk about the problems they faced playing in those almost empty stadiums in the Emirates. But at least there were some people there. There were some people to respond to. Playing in front of nobody at all is for 5 days is quite an ordeal for any player.
I have to say, I'm not sure you're right about that. I've spent my whole life, 50 years almost, playing cricket. And occasionally we've had three or four people, an old man and a dog or something watching. But generally, my whole experience of cricket playing is not in front of a great audience. And I carried on merrily.
Indeed, but you and I, Peter, are used to playing under those conditions. For, you know, for great players, it's quite a shock having nobody to respond to at all, nobody to admire your performance. They won't even be able to have their families at the ground. So I know it's particularly important to the Pakistani players, because they've told me so. Empty stadiums are not popular with television. Television needs to show matches that are real events. And when you see an empty stadium, you're almost inviting the audience at home to say, there's nothing important, there's nothing going on here. Why would
I don't agree with you about this. In these special circumstances, there'll be a massive TV audience from people at home. It'll really kind of raise the morale around the country. All right, it'll be in front of an empty stadium, but they'll be being watched on the telly hugely. And so I'm not sure I accept what you're saying.
Well, I've got a feeling that broadcasters will still insert fake crowd noise and fake cutaways to simulate the atmosphere of a real match. There are some other problems, technical problems. Umpires have to be in close proximity, square leg, still less at the bowler's end. So all the umpiring will be done from upstairs by the third umpire.
And there's a question of the ball, isn't there? I mean, obviously, the ball is fielded and then thrown back to the bowler via the wicketkeeper. So the ball itself, of course, goes from hand to hand.
It does. It might go to 15 different hands, including the umpires. There'll have to be new rules, I think, about sterilising it at certain intervals. And then there'll be tests about which sterilisers impart reverse swing to the ball most effectively. And there'll be complaints about the ball being sterilised on only one half to make it swing better. Already, some of the major fast bowlers in the world are very worried about the fact that they won't be able to put saliva on the ball, and saliva with the right kind of sweets being sucked to help the swing.
I think that's too much information there.
Jasprit Bumrah and Josh Hazlewood and Pat Cummins of Australia, they've all expressed a lot of worry. It only puts them on a level with baseball pitchers, because you may not spit on the ball in baseball. You're sent off immediately if you do. There are other problems I'm worried about in social distancing cricket. I don't know how the press box will function. Media is going to presumably have to report the television pictures, in which case, why do you have independent media at all? Why do you have journalists if they can't see what's going on at the ground themselves and interpret what's going on at the ground? If you can't have John Arlott conveying personally the atmosphere of a match, or even Henry Blofeld chattering about the pigeons and the buses.
As I understand it, the English Cricket Board has said no professional cricket until 28th May at the earliest. Well, that's just barely a month away now, and that can be contingent on government rules on social distancing. What about recreational cricket, the sort of cricket that you and I play? In village cricket, you can avoid meeting people, you know, close up. You can avoid going into the pavilion where you're cheap by jowl. And I think it'd be very good for morale to have sport return over the summer.
Well, people are going to have to change outdoors by the sound of it.
That's all right.
Dressing rooms we use are very, very cramped. Not going to be able to shower together afterwards.
That's a great relief.
Showers are minimal and very, very cramped. Smaller pitches. Occurs to me that in major matches, if there's a fielding circle, they'll have to change the rules and people will have to stand outside it rather than have players inside it. No slips in any sort of cricket. Keeper probably can't stand up to the stumps. Shared kit's going to be a problem in recreational cricket. It's pretty horrific anyway, the kit you have to share. It's usually never cleaned or washed. But I'm thinking there's a special problem about sharing helmets, as you so often have to do. Sharing a helmet which has probably been sneezed in and coughed in by the previous occupant. Another problem in recreational cricket, teams like ours are usually full of eager loyalists, people who turn up with coughs and colds to avoid letting the team down. And when you think about it now, that's completely the wrong attitude. This virus, you know, has made heroes of hypochondriacs and slackers.
Powers who organise international cricket, English Cricket Board, the ICC, what are they saying at the moment?
As far as I can make out, the ICC hasn't made a statement about any prospect of resuming world cricket. It all seems to be in the hands of national authorities. The ECB has issued guidance on both professional cricket and recreational cricket, as we said. So far, it's still, I think, in the unrealistic assumption that cricket in England might resume on the 28th of May. I get the impression, frankly, that the ECB is hoping for the best. Certainly, recreational cricket, under the control of the ECB, is suspended until further notice. And that's all forms of recreational cricket, even nets, even coaching. And the ECB has announced a fund to help out both professional and recreational cricket. It's £61 million of its own money. That suggests to me that they expect quite a long lockdown for both types of the game.
And one benefit of this, of course, is that the awful 100 might not take place, which has been something which we both regard, I think, as a malign distortion of the game of cricket.
Nobody wants to introduce a brand new form of the game with totally new teams in a truncated season, when you've already lost many of the selling opportunities to get people to go to these wretched matches.
Is there a morale issue, though? Plum Warner, great cricket administrator of the middle of the last century, said it would be a victory for Goebbels if the Nazis had been able to stop cricket being played in World War II. So it did actually continue, Richard.
Well, they did continue it, but the virus, our enemy now, doesn't care if we play cricket or not. And there aren't going to be any war films showing, you know, a baffled virus admiring the English pluck. This is an enemy which doesn't care what we do. It doesn't care whether we're courageous or despairing. It will take its own course. We've got to all of us, you know, cricketers and otherwise, we have to cooperate in all the measures that are necessary to beat it.
But national morale is an issue, and if we can play cricket, as I think we can, without risking spreading infection, then we should go ahead and do it, shouldn't we?
Cricket being played would contribute something to national morale, but so would the restoration of other sports that have been suspended too. And one thing we've got to work out, think about, in whether the cricket season is going to be restored is whether the football season is going to be restored. Football season was suspended, there's important matches to complete. Football has got a much bigger participation than cricket, and it's got a much bigger television following than cricket. Football will make the claim to be let off restrictions. Cricket will follow in its wake. A lot of other sports have many more adherents, frankly, than many more participants than cricket. They'll be, as it were, first in the queue for any relaxation. Cricket's going to have to lobby very strongly, very vigorously, to get relaxations out of a government that I think will be very, very nervous about relaxing restrictions for any activity that's non-essential and doesn't contribute much to the economy, which they're very focused on.
Are you saying that you don't think that we will play any recreational cricket or watch any test match, first-class cricket for all of this beautiful summer, which has really been the most beautiful start to a summer I can remember?
At the risk of being an Eeyore, yes, I think we might have lost this whole season. It's bad enough for professional cricket, which has got a little bit of cushion of money and support behind it, but it will be devastating for recreational cricket and for local clubs, which depend so heavily on actually playing matches, on the receipts that they get from the social activity associated with matches, the bar takings. If recreational cricket's restored, they're not going to get any income from the bar. We're not going to be able to congregate there. This is a terrific blow to the income of recreational clubs. Cricket's a very expensive game. It's a high-maintenance game. They've got a lot of costs and upkeep of grounds to meet with no income.
The other thing which really hits me hard is young players, you know, in that pivotal 16, 17-year-olds who are really progressing in the game and then just lose at that vital moment a whole year of their career.
Yes, I think that's true for all children. I think it's, if anything, more serious at the early stages when children have a wide choice of sport. Cricket's very much a developmental sport. You need to keep children involved in it sort of year after year and to make progress in it. It's much easier to play games like, it might be tennis and soccer, up to a certain level and to take a break from them. Say swimming or cycling or running, which you can just pick up again without any further ado. I feel especially sorry for the parents taking out a second mortgage to buy the cricket kit necessary for, a 12-year-old and now going to watch it being outgrown before it's even used.
Well, I feel more optimistic than you. I predict two things. One, I run a little cricket team. We're no good, but we love it. And we take an annual tour to Ireland. I'm hopeful by the end of the year that we'll be able to get to Ireland and be drinking Guinness in the pub beforehand and playing a game of cricket or two with the Irish. And I also think that your club, which I have had the honour of playing for many times, the Erratics, will play by the end of the season.
Well, I'd love to believe that. I fear that for players like me, this season may be the end and we may at last have reached that sunset in our careers, which, in my case, people have recommended I accept a long time ago.
Well, I'm not as pessimistic as you. I can't bear the thought of a summer without cricket. It's so painful. It's so miserable.
But if there is no cricket, we will just have to be philosophical about it. And talking of philosophy, I think it's time to introduce another member of our Philosopher's Cricket 11. Number one, Socrates.
Socrates. I didn't know that he was a cricketer, Richard.
Very much a cricketer, very much an all-round sportsman. He began, actually, as a pioneer of early football in Athens. And did you know that soccer was actually named after him?
It's one of the things I didn't know.
Yep. He appeared, actually, in Athens' very first international football match against Epirus. At least one cap for Athens. But he had a lot of knee trouble, which ended his football career. In fact, he got to be known in the football world as Peloponnese, and Peloponnese.
Now, surely there is a problem with Socrates' career, namely that, I'm pretty hazy on this sort of thing, but isn't it the case that nothing which he said or did is recorded firsthand? Plato pass on his great thoughts and wisdom to the rest of us. He therefore falls into the category of a mythical player who we depend on for third parties to give us accounts of without actually having any... Like, he's not in the scorebook. That's what I'm trying to say. He's not in the scorebook.
Well, he's in a lot of scorebooks, but they were made by Plato retrospectively, and there's a lot of doubt about them. There are no vase paintings of Socrates as a cricketer, so we've no idea what he looked like in action. He was very, very lucky to have Plato as a scorer, but it's only on Plato's authority that he was an obdurate opener for Athens, particularly against Sparta in the grudge match against Sparta. But eventually he ran into a lot of trouble because Socrates kept questioning the umpire's decision, even the ones in his favour.
This brings us on to a memorable article written by Anthony McGann in Night Watchman magazine. Would certain philosophers have walked? Would Socrates have walked?
Well, you know, McGowan goes on to say yes, because look at the way he met his death. You know, put on trial for denying the gods and corrupting the young, found guilty. And then this is a very important passage from McGowan. Although his friends offered to spirit him away, Socrates argued that it was only right for him to obey the laws of his city. He calmly took the hemlock and shuffled off to the great pavilion in the sky. So we can be sure that he never questioned the umpire's decision. Rubbish, I'm afraid. Complete rubbish. The only problem is that the whole death of Socrates was another of Plato's noble lies. I mean, Plato was the earliest practitioner of fake news. He invented a lot of things. He wanted people to believe the best of Socrates. Socrates didn't drink any hemlock. Socrates did accept his friend's offer to spirit him away, and they spirited him away, as it so often happens, to Brazil, because there was no extradition treaty in force between Brazil and Athens. It's a factor that's involved, that's influenced a lot of people to take exile in Brazil later on. Socrates had a second life in Brazil. He fathered a child there. He went back to his first love of football, and his descendants formed a great football-playing dynasty. And his most famous descendant, many, many times over, took his name of Socrates and became one of Brazil's best ever players.
What I hadn't realised, Richard, was that Brazilian Socrates, a marvellous player, was a descendant of the Greek philosopher. And I noticed you were accusing Plato of disseminating fake news there. I'm so glad that you're not in any way doing the same thing.
Socrates was indeed one of the all-time greats of Brazilian football. The original Socrates, though, has a unique record. He is the only man to win international honours for cricket, football and reason.
Now, last week, we mentioned the mysterious Colonel L.C. Stevens and wondered why he was able to raise powerful cricket teams in his own name in the post-war epoch. We couldn't solve this mystery, but we received a very interesting and memorable letter from our great friend Afzal Ahmed in Karachi. And Afzal told us quite a lot of information about Colonel Stevens.
He did. Afzal directed us to his Wisden obituary in particular. It seems to have dominated sporting life in Eastbourne. After the Second World War, raised many teams. He met touring sides from overseas, etc., etc. President of Eastbourne Cricket and Football Club for over 30 years. President of Eastbourne Rugby Football Club. Played cricket, association and rugby football. Represented Sussex at rugby, not at cricket. Never played any first-class cricket himself. Founder headmaster of Chelmsford Hall Preparatory School. All very interesting, but doesn't quite explain his mysterious pull in the game. Why he found it so easy to recruit important and prestigious first-class players to play for him. I mean, Eastbourne's a nice place to play cricket, but still think there's a mystery about Colonel Stevens. Why? What was his authority and influence in the game, and where did it come from? And delighted if listeners could fill us in with a bit more about the mysterious Colonel.
I do admire him so much, though. I mean, there was a period, just the beginning of international air travel, and before sort of the modern sort of jamboree of cricket took off, when people like him could raise these teams. Another, of course, was E.W. Swanson, cricket writer, magisterial summariser. He founded the Arabs, took tours to the West Indies with first-class players, and Colin Ingleby McKenzie, his touring captain, in the great tradition, he said that there was a rule of absolutely had to be adhered to, that players had to be in bed by 11 o'clock before their matches, that is 11 a.m. in the morning of the match.
He did. He was. That was Ingleby McKenzie's way. Loads of stories about that and the methods he encouraged in his team. He won the county championship with those methods in 1961 for Hampshire. Another very influential figure in this category was D.H. Robbins, Derek Robbins, who actually took over the Eastbourne Festival from Colonel Stevens. He was a very successful businessman, but he formed his own 11 and actually played for it. He played for his 11 against the visiting Indians in 1971 and made him the oldest man to play a first-class match in England at the age of 57. That said, he didn't bowl, he didn't bat or take a catch, but he was still on the field for 3 days. First-class match, age 57. In that Indian match is a name that we know very well, Abid Ali.
Abid Ali?
Abid Ali was in there. India's all-rounder in the 60s and 70s. He was, shall we say, a medium bowler used to take the shine off the ball before the great spinners came on. But we had him as our sort of professional and inspired coach in the wonderful tour of the United States and the California leg of the American tour that we made with our friend Michael Bowes.
25 years ago, that was.
Good Lord, it was too.
It was the year that Beckham announced himself by scoring that amazing goal from the halfway line. Do you remember? At the very start of the English football season, was it 1997, 1995?
95 was the year. It was our year of the States and the year we met Abid, so must have been Beckham's year.
I remember we played Hollywood. George Lazenby.
We did. I bowled James Bond.
No.
He missed Mallorca.
Wow.
I think he played too soon, like so many people did. It was a deceptively slow Yorker. But
Lazenby only did one Bond, didn't he, on Her Majesty's Secret Service, which I thought was particularly good Bond, one of the very best, actually, but he was sacked.
It was a good Bond, but he's made a very good living being an ex-Bond. He does a lot of personal appearances and sort of after-dinner speeches, and he's very funny about his experiences as Bond. He's a very nice victim to be able to claim.
But I just going back to D.H. Robbins, didn't he disgrace himself at the end of his career by taking rebel sides to South Africa?
Yeah, he led four tours to South Africa in the 70s, defying the ban on cricket with South Africa, playing basically under apartheid conditions. He claimed that he was non-political, but quite honestly, those tours were objectively political. They were played under apartheid conditions, and he eventually settled in South Africa. Obviously, lived on after apartheid was over. He died there, age 90.
Would you place D.H. Robbins, despite his moral failings at the end of his life, in the kind of tradition of great sort of sponsors of cricket, like Julian Kahn in the 1930s springs to mind?
Julian Kahn, very mixed reputation. I must say, I rather admire Julian Kahn because he was a rich furniture trader. He bought his own cricket team. He played for it. He was terrified of the hard ball. He loved cricket, but he was terrified of the hard ball. And he played in special inflatable pads, which were blown up by his footman. He was a terrible player. He scored 70 runs in his 10 matches. And some of those were leg byes that were given to him. And that's something that happens, I think, to a lot of famous patrons. He had a very equivocal reputation in the cricket world. A lot of people were happy to take his money and then make snide remarks behind his back because he was A, Jewish, and B, in trade. He did a lot of work outside cricket as a philanthropist. He saved Newstead Abbey, Byron's home for the nation, endowed a maternity hospital, became a baronet, built himself a theatre where he performed as a conjurer. I think if I had the money, I would sort of fulfil my own fantasies in the same sort of way as Julian Kahn.
I cannot fault him in any of that. I think he's marvellous, actually. I love this. And Nawaz Sharif, reminds me a little bit of the Pakistan Prime Minister, just in the little matter of the leg byes suddenly turning into runs. Nawaz Sharif when he was Prime Minister, used to go to the, as we discovered writing our book together, he would fly in from Islamabad, from the Prime Minister's office, to Lahore and play cricket there on Saturdays. Remind me what happened when he hit the ball towards the boundary, Richard.
We got into very bad trouble for this phrase. The staff were in the field, and if he hit an aggressive stroke, as it was described to us, the ball was not so much intercepted as escorted to the boundary.
I also recollect that often government official or political officials would be umpiring, and LBW decisions were rarely... So it was said. I'm sure this is false gossip.
Well, I think also a lot of retrospective no balls were given against the bowler who was unlucky enough to bowl the Prime Minister. The Munchie, that's something that Hanif Mohammed benefited from with his great Pakistan batsman, was quite lucky with his early coach, Master Aziz, who was very good at suddenly spotting a no ball when Hanif had been bowled as a schoolboy. But we got into very bad trouble with that coverage of Nawaz Sharif in the first book, and I tried to make amends when we were preparing the second book, and I asked for an interview with Nawaz Sharif, and I sent a list of questions in advance, and the first of them ran, "Prime Minister, could you tell us how your cricket career helped you to bring Pakistan cricket to heights never before attempted, let alone achieved?" But you know, he still didn't give me an interview. Still not on speaking terms with us.
We got very cold vibes from the Prime Minister's office when we tried to approach Nawaz Sharif. Even actually when we were writing the first book, he didn't want to have his cricket career too closely examined. He played a first-class match, Nawaz Sharif, didn't he? He liked D.H. Robbins and Colonel Stevens even. I think he had some first-class experience.
He did. He was very proud of it. He opened the batting for Railways as a railwayman. I don't think he ever was a conductor on Pakistan Railways, or still less a driver or a stoker, but he played as an opener for the Railways and sadly was out third ball for naught. They won the match by an innings, so he didn't get a second chance, like so many of us. But he loved, you know, he first of Pakistan's prime ministers to have a first-class record.
He stands in a very rich tradition, however, of stately or grand figures who have exotic cricket careers. I'm thinking of, for instance, but we might come on to some more of them, before World War One, the Maharaja of Kashmir, who never fielded and would be up in his house only to be summoned to bat by telephone when his time came, and he would get in his Rolls Royce and drive slowly down to the cricket field.
Yes, he did. It was very undignified for a Maharaja to run, so he had a runner for him. He just would play some sparkling strokes. They'd be run, or they were escorted at the boundary too. He boasted, the Maharaja of Kashmir, he boasted to Ranji once that he'd scored more centuries than Ranji and had never been out for a duck.
Yes, I don't think that his officials who were umpiring would have any...
It's probably high treason.
To give him out.
Yes.
But he was the sort of spiritual progenitor of the appalling Maharaja of Porbandar, the captain on the Indian tour of... That's not appalling, but it's certainly...
Well, he was very appalling as a cricketer. He had no ability at all. He was very good at the social side of the tour. He scored 2 runs on the entire tour, and it was said that he had more Rolls Royces than runs. He did do one very good thing for the team, which was not to select himself for the test matches. He handed over the captaincy to Naidu's best player. Unlike his disgraceful successor in 1936, the Maharaja of Vizianagaram.
Who did score a few runs, though, didn't he? Vizianagaram wasn't as dreadful a cricketer as the Maharaja of Porbandar, was he?
Wasn't as dreadful a cricketer, but he did begin each of his innings by giving a gold watch to the opposing captain. And he got fed quite a lot of long hops and full tosses before finally, you know, the captain would allow the bowler to, you know, do a fast in-swinging Yorker or something like that. He was a very bad man for sucking up to authority. He sucked up to the Viceroy of India.
Well, that's how he got appointed, wasn't it? That's how he became captain of the touring party in the first place, wasn't it?
Yes, it was internal politics. Patiala was due to lead the side as the touring captain, certainly lead it on the social side, but Patiala, as I remember, he virtually bribed the Viceroy. But he was really a shocking touring captain. Fought with his best players, Naidu and Merchant. He tried to get them both run out in the actual test matches. He sacked his best all-rounder, Lala Amarnath, midway through the tour. And yet, you know, such as the forgiveness of cricket, he became a very popular radio commentator years later. And everybody said, Vizzy, ex-captain of India, you know, and he had a great authority.
The figure of that type who most reminds me, going back to our hero Colonel Stevens, is the peer of Perugaro, because he's the same sort of time, the 50s and the 60s. And the peer would host touring teams who came to Pakistan in the early post-colonial, post-independence era, because we researched and investigated the Pera Pagaro. And what were the things we discovered, Richard?
Well, the major fact about him is that he's the only living saint to have played first-class cricket. Pakistan has a lot of hereditary saints. He was one of them. He was the leader of the Hur, H-U-R, clan. His father was executed for connection with an anti-British rising during the Second World War. And he, the son, was sent to away to school in Middlesex, and that's where he became a cricket lover. He came back to Pakistan when Pakistan was independent. As you say, he was a very early patron of Pakistan cricket, included a lot of support for the great Muhammad brothers. He played touring teams, leading his own side, and it's one very unpleasant incident where he actually got hit by a touring fast bowler, and his Hur followers very nearly lynched the visitors. But the peer rose from his injury and managed to restrain them in time. I think a very worthy figure.
No, he's one of my absolute all-time heroes. He had real passion and enthusiasm for cricket, which kind of shines through his entire career. And those early matches, it is like, you know, the Duke of Norfolk's 11 when the Australians came and the first match was the Duke of Norfolk's 11. The touring teams to Pakistan in the early years, their first match, the Pera Pagaro's 11, a man of huge, huge lustre. And of course, his many followers who protected him with their lives. I mean, it was a very, very serious matter.
It was indeed. He went on to form a political party. He was involved in Pakistan politics for quite a long time, but not, I think, on the cricketing side. Although his love of cricket, you know, stayed with him, and I think he went on supporting quite a lot of cricketers individually.
One of the joys of researching Pakistan cricket, even at a local level, was the number of people who played first-class cricket through adroit use of local influence.
Well, that's the great thing. You look at a lot of scorecards of early Pakistan cricket, 50s, 60s, even sometimes later, and you see some chap, he bats at 9, 10 or 11, he doesn't bowl, he doesn't take a catch, and you think, what's he doing in the side? Very often he's the captain. And I looked at one of these players once, and he was actually captain in a test match trial against the opposing captain, was the great Imtiaz Ahmed, Pakistan's wicketkeeper batsman. He's this sort of unknown leading a test trial 11 against him. And I asked somebody, who was he? And they said, oh, he was the local chief of police. You know, and he fancied a game. So, you know, he gave himself a very good game. And I must say, if I had the authority and the money, I would have awarded myself, I think I'd have awarded myself a test match trial, but I would have bought myself at least one first-class match.
Well, we have been lucky. We've both played, through the use of, frankly, patronage, great players, haven't we? I mean, I've played alongside, actually, David Gower in a match at Stocks about 30 years ago. I have to say, that Gower, he was so nice about it, playing with all these idiots.
Yeah, I have a lot of respect for players like that who play celebrity cricket. I played a lot of it through the media. I also played at Stocks. I've played quite a lot, made a lot of famous cricketers through the Lords and Commons as well. I had an experience, we both played at Stocks, I think, under Stuart Stephen, the legendary editor of the Mail on Sunday. I certainly played against him, against Phil Edmonds's team at Stocks Country Club, which used to be the Playboy Country Club. And the sides I played for, Stuart's always had his sort of the editor's cricket match there for several years. And the sides were always mixed up. And that's why I managed to come on as first change to an opening attack of Dennis Lilly and Imran Khan. And they couldn't have been nicer. Though I have to say, when I came on to bowl, and as you know, I had a very unusual action then. I bowled my first delivery, involved a lot of whirls of the arm. Bowled my first delivery, and I heard of Dennis Lilly at mid-on. I heard him say, Stroth. I've never seen anything like that in my whole career. Never. And then he very, rather melodramatically, pretended to reflect and said, no, no, there was this bloke in Victoria, grade three, was just a little bit like that. But no, 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 nothing really, nothing really.
I got to know Stuart Stephen, who, went, not at the Mail on Sunday, well, I was on the Evening Standard, where he was propelled, much against his will, to become editor in, I think it was 1992, and I was a junior reporter at the time. And he had this fabulous love of cricket, and I still remember, actually, being, when there was a terrible moment, I think it was the back end of 92, was it 93, when the Ted Dexter, the chairman of the England selectors, dropped David Gower from the touring party to go to India. And it wasn't a monstrous decision by Dexter and the selectors. And I rang up the comment desk of the Evening Standard and I said, I want to have an op-ed. It's a ghastly moment when England's greatest batsman and most beautiful batsman is dropped from the tour. And I was told, no, you can't do that. Stuart Stevens writing that piece. He came here 5 minutes ago. And he wrote a glorious, glorious piece. And he then turned the Evening Standard, having turned up from the Mail on Sunday, where you worked for him, into a great paper which promoted John Major. Now, that was a losing cause in the 1990s. And I have to say, at the time, it drove me bonkers because it wasn't the mood of the moment. But in retrospect, I think he was dead right.
Well, Mr. Major's, Sir John Major's, looking better in retrospect, as you say, than as he looked, you know, at the time. He endured a lot of satire and criticism.
When I was researching my biography of Basil D'Oliveira, actually Basil told me this, he said it was very controversial whether or not Basil went on the 70-71 England tour of Australia. The Ashes series. There was a lot of people mobilising against him. And Ray Illingworth, the captain, really stood up for Basil. And he said, no, and he got hold of Basil. He said, you're going to behave. Because the case against Basil was that he was a bit of a hellraiser. He said, on this tour, I'll look after you, but you've got to look after me. And that there was a famous innings which Basil played. And I think the third test, he scored 117 match-winning runs. And overnight, he'd been something like 20 not out. And Basil said that he went back and he was mindful of what Ray Illingworth had said to him. He was heading to an early bed when he bumped into Trevor Howard. And Howard said, have a drink and another. And he went back to Howard's room. And Basil said that he didn't actually go to bed till about 5 in the morning.
Yeah.
And I think that was terrible by Howard, because he was there to follow the test match. He knew cricket. He understood cricket. He knew that Basil was not out. He had to be clear-minded at the crease, and yet he kept him up all night boozing. I think they got through, you know, they were both big drinkers, and they got through plenty. And Basil said that when he got to the game the following morning and was warming up in the nets, Illingworth knew exactly what sort of state he was in because he could smell his breath. Huh. Now, as it happens, Basil went on and did score a century. It was a great innings. But, you know, he was... Just imagine if he'd been out. So he might easily have been just bad luck, apart from anything else, earlier the following morning, the way it would have felt and looked.
I think that's typical movie star behaviour. There are a lot of movie stars who just make their entourage drink with them all night. And I think it's very wrong for Trevor Howard to have turned a great sportsman like Basil D'Oliveira into one of his entourage and treat him that way.
By the way, I think I'm right in saying that Terence Rattigan also had written in, as screenwriter, this clause.
Yes, he was a great cricket lover, but though his a lot of his work as a dramatist was influenced by his dropping from the Harrow 11 in 1930. He opened the batting for Harrow at Lord's with Victor Rothschild in 1929. He was very stylish, but in 1930 he was dropped, and apparently he never got over it. And that adds to the note of melancholy and disappointment sometimes that very often you see in Terence Rattigan play.
Victor Rothschild and Terence Rattigan opening the batting together for Harrow versus Eton at Lord's in 1929. Now, that's an image, isn't it, of those two, I think, the greatest dramatist of the 20th century.
Very much coming back into fashion. Out of fashion for a long time, very, very much reclaiming his status as a major dramatist. Terence Rattigan had to do a lot of hack work as a... He made a lot of money out of it, but he had to do a lot of hack work as a screenwriter at the end of his days. But his stage plays very much restored to favour, getting a lot of performance again.
Yeah, he became very unfashionable, really, in the late 50s, early 60s, of the emergence of playwrights who I find quite hard work, Beckett in particular. And he was sort of the kind of fashionable world rather took against him. But for plays like The Winslow Boy, I just find just gripping. Separate Tables, I mean, wonderful plays.
They are. They film very well. And actors like being in them. They love being cast in them. There are meaty parts. For, you know, he was a very, very fine craftsman.
And he and Victor, of course, one of the also one of the most fascinating men of the 20th century, great banker, great intelligence man, great advisor to prime ministers, a really terrific. And I hadn't realised actually that he was also a cricketer.
Played quite a lot of first class cricket.
Victor, really?
Yeah, you'd think he was captain of Northamptonshire, not a very strong county, and. You know, obviously, a lot of amateur captains were not terribly good in that era, but Victor, I think, was played captain Northamptonshire and played quite a few matches for them in the 30s, before taking up all his other activities.
Richard, you really are full of information.
Well, thank you for saying so, and now in a position to satisfy the curiosity of a lot of listeners about the infamous run-out of Geoffrey Archer and the disastrous events surrounding it, because a few details of this have been cleared in heavily redacted...
No, sorry, Richard, that's all we've got time for. We're going to be back next week. It's goodbye from me in Wiltshire and...
It's goodbye from me in South East London.